So, this is my 45th Mother's Day sermon. And I was going to start out with a joke, which is, I got nothing left. I have said it all, done it all, but I'm not starting with that joke because I actually learned something during the hymn about why I was crying. And I'll get to that. I hope, in the body of the sermon. Because the truth is that even when we visit and revisit events and celebrations and holidays, if we are open to new feelings and new insights, they can come at very unexpected moments. And we make connections. A piece of music can set off a memory and make a connection. A smell coming from the kitchen. The tone of voice that we hear in ourselves or in our children, and we are taken back and we feel, which is even more important than remembering. So as Obama has on gay marriage, I have evolved on Mother's Day. I started out Mother's Day in the default position of sentimentality, preaching Mother's Day sermons that would put any brittle diabetic into ketosis and ultimately into shock. It was pretty not genuine given my experience at the time, and was kind of by the book. It was my idea of what a Mother's Day sermon should be, as opposed to what was coming out of my own experiences and insights. I went on from that, this being Berkeley in the 60s, to denounce Mother's Day as a cynical plot foisted by the florists and the greeting card industry. Some truth to that, we'll get to it. And so I was anti-Mother's Day, which is really, when you show up at Mother's Day with your flowers and your hat with flowers on it, and there's going to be a Mother's Day brunch, and then the clergy person gets up there condemning Mother's Day. It just is not that appropriate. I had a colleague who preached his abortion sermon on Mother's Day. I'm not making this up. The sermon was just fine, but you know, couldn't it have waited and you know till Easter or something? I don't know. Then I got into that Berkeley cynicism of Philip Wiley and Momism, a book called The Generation of Vipers that condemned motherhood. And then we got into the Berkeley thing of if you've chosen motherhood, you're a traitor to your gender, and motherhood is self-hatred, really, for any woman, and it's also bad for the planet. Because we were all zero population growth, which was really fun when you go to a Unitarian Universalist congregation and they're saying, we're zero growth, zero growth, zero growth. Why is the RE program so small? We had this evangelical movement with all of the, made as much sense as the Shakers wondering where it was going because, you know, you lit a candle if somebody became pregnant, and it was one of concern for the planet. For the planet. So I went through all of that kind of stuff, and then I got to the gender stereotyping, which is, well, look, you really don't have to be a woman to be a mother. Anybody can mother. And I thought, well, I'm even a semi-official honorary mother because I stayed home days while my wife taught with my son, and then I would go to my congregation weekends and two evenings a week. So I was a mom, and then I became a carpool mom, driving the carpool, and because gender was all an illusion, and it was all in teaching. And if we only set the right examples, we could make girls who were just as violent and irrational and crazy as guys. Thank God we kind of failed in that. And so I've been all over the map on Mother's Day. But the most horrifying thing that I had to deal with was in this kind of rejectionist position to be told that it was actually a Unitarian holiday founded by Unitarian women, and that it was subversive at its roots, that it wanted recognition and pay and rights for women. It was a post-labor movement that really wanted to empower women with more than just flowers and cards. But its radical roots got dyed by the flower and card industry, and we kind of lost it for a number of generations. Until we started talking again about where Mother's Day really came from and what it was honoring, the kind of dedication, the kind of love, the kind of opening of heart and life to another human being that is remarkable. It is remarkable. Yes, some of it is baked into the genes. We can see it in the animal world. But we human beings have a great and difficult challenge because we can transcend our genes and our programming in good ways or in bad ways. And we can unlearn the bonding and the loving that we would naturally otherwise feel. Some say that you really don't appreciate your mother until she's gone. I don't know that that has to be true. Certainly mortality does kind of call your attention to what's going on and seems to frustrate the ability to heal, to have rapprochement. But I think that I started to appreciate my mother almost the moment my first child was born. I think sometime around 3 o'clock in the morning, on the third diaper, but since 2 o'clock in the morning, I started wondering why she didn't strangle me at birth. And incidentally, there were often times that she had that same question. In one Mother's Day, I remember I had her as the associate in the Studio City congregation, and she got up there and said, "Oh, Jonathan was just perfect. He was wonderful. He never gave me a moment's worry or concern." And then he was born. And everything changed. Yeah, now you know where I got it. Like it or don't like it, that's where I got it. And I remember as a young father, not really thinking that I'm a mother, although I have to tell you this, and I can only do it now as a short timer because it's not a pretty picture. I, as a young, brand new father with my son just home, I didn't realize that when you get up to pick up your infant, screaming, hungry child, that you probably should put a t-shirt on because I picked him up and he latched and I screamed. And then he started spitting out hair because I am an hairy man. I appreciated my hairless mother at that point a lot. The walking up and down the halls at night with an uncomfortable child, a child with an earache, crying, with croup, with strep, with all those things, And to know that you would put yourself in his or her spot in a second rather than feeling not completely helpless, but seriously helpless against the pain, against the fever, against these feelings that this child is not old enough to understand. And to be able to, in a sense, be opened up by understanding how quickly, willingly, instinctively, and generously we would give everything for the sake of that child. That doesn't mean that there are not those moments, because there are those moments. And it doesn't mean that my mother was perfect in every way. She did coach me in public speech. She helped me cheat in order to win contests. The first speech contest I was entered in, I'm sorry, that she entered me in, we had the possibility of five different subjects for which we were supposed to give an extemporaneous speech. She made me write five speeches and memorize all five so that whichever one I drew spontaneously, I would be able to speak to it. And I did, and I won. And that taught me a valuable lesson. Not cheating, preparation. And when I joke to people, I'm going into the office for 5 minutes to rehearse my ad libs, I'm aware that that is actually true. And the secret of ease and fluency is preparation. She taught me that. But she was not perfect. She also lied to me. She said, "Honey, you really can sing." And the rest of the world seemed to disagree with her. And she's kind of, who are you going to believe, you know, me or them? And I said, well, the disadvantage here is that you love me. And she said, no, you're just a natural singer of harmony. It took me a couple of years to figure out what that meant. It was like the shoe salesman telling my wife, why, you have flexible arches, flat feet. So she wasn't perfect in every way, but she taught me a love of politics, of people, of humor, of open conversation, of argumentation, and of both receiving and giving guilt. And that's important. I mean, it's an inoculation that if you take enough in your youth, it doesn't bother you as much when you're older. I also have to tell you that we were estranged for a period of time, for about 10 years. Not that I never saw her, but we were estranged because I thought that I should have had a vote in terms of her second husband, and I didn't. And she shouldn't have. So there was an impediment between us that was serious. But even before it was reconciled, I knew her. When my first wife and I went into the Peace Corps, we were gone for 2 years in Tunisia, and I wrote to my mother faithfully twice a year. My brother, who was in India, wrote to her faithfully once a week. I was the better brother because if he didn't write, she was calling the embassy, scared to death that he was dead somewhere. And when I didn't write, she just figured, oh, it's John. So I was really, in the long run, kinder to her. But when we were sailing back into New York, I said to my wife, Barbara, she's going to be at the dock. And Barbara said, what are you talking about? She lives in California. She hates air travel. She's not going to be at the dock. She's going to be at the dock. We're pulling in, and there's my mother on the dock. I knew it. So what I learned this morning when I was crying, and I've cried every year that Judy has picked this, and she knows it, and she does it just to get to me, and it works every year. But it only worked and it only started after my first grandchild was born. And only today did I realize why it got me. My mother was alive when for my son's wedding and my daughter-in-law, she was also involved in that. And she knew that they were pregnant and she visited. And she would put the hand on the tummy, and she really wanted to be here for the birth. She started, my daughter-in-law is ethnic Korean, and my mother started cutting out pictures of Eurasian children and putting them on her wall just in case she didn't make it. And she didn't. She missed it by 3 weeks. And our little story was, and again, religiously take this, poetically, not literally, we had the sense of one dobra going up into the heavens and another dobra descending down onto earth. and took some solace from that, if not cycle of life, at least escalator of life. And so I'm crying because I know how much my mother would have appreciated getting to know and getting to hold Roxy in her arms. I'm also aware that my late former wife, Barbara, was alive for the birth and for her first year, and she too tried very hard to stay on this planet for the sake of being connected to precious grandchildren who tie us at any age to the future. When the world is complicated and violent and we might want to just withdraw and sit alone in silence, not for a moment of respite, but for a long time and disconnect from the world, our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, whether they are biologically ours or not, they connect us to the future, give us a role in tomorrow and the day after tomorrow, so that we cannot say, I'm old, never mind, let the world do what it will. We still have a stake. Our hearts still have a stake. My mother's favorite guilt trip was every time I visited, it was, number one, you're not eating enough. You've gained weight, but you're not eating enough. I've had trouble putting that together. This is literally both true and factual. I went to her apartment once, and she said, I went to one market and got these beautiful pears, to another market, got this wonderful apple. So I sit down, I pick the pear. She said, you don't like the apple? Same visit. When I walked in, she said, you've put on weight, darling. A boy gets confused. And then, when am I going to see you again? Okay, I'll see you Tuesday, if I live. If not, I'll see you Thursday. Love, guilt, and humor in one line. That was a precious gift, memory, and legacy.